My name's Guy Somerset. I'm the Books and Culture Editor of the New Zealand Listener, and I'm here with the second of today's podcasts from the New Zealand Post Book Awards. This time, talking to Paula Morris, who won the prize for Best Fiction and has been one of the three fiction writers who we have been talking about over the past month as part of our New Zealand Listener Book Club. Now, Paula, you have been a pundit for the Listener for many years on different lists of finalists. What was it like this time being on the other side of the fence?
Sorry, I'm laughing. Is this all right? Am I sitting too close or too far away? Do you want me to sit on the table? I know this is all going in the podcast. I don't even care.
It's starting to sound like a lap dance, but anyway, go on.
Okay, I'm sitting on the table. I'm just laughing because you're calling me a pundit, and I've never been called a pundit before.
Well, the highest accolade that a journalist can give anybody.
But isn't that really, a pundit means just someone with a lot of opinion and no particular expertise. So what was it like being at the awards? It was nerve-wracking, actually, and horrible, and I didn't realise it would be like that, because I'd been to the awards before over the years. It's 10 years since my first novel was published, Queen of Beauty. And so in 2003, it won Best First Book at the awards. So I went along for that, but Best First Book, you know you've won before you go. And then I've been twice as Reviewer of the Year, as part of the contest for that. Both times I lost to other Listener writers, actually, David Eggleton and Jaleesa Gracewood. But I didn't really care about that. You know, it's not quite so personal. So last night felt really odd, actually. It was very stressful, and I had half my family there too, which sort of adds to the stress, because you know that they'll be disappointed.
And do you look the other writers in the eye during the course of the evening, the other two, or do you try and avoid them at all costs?
No, of course. I went up and said hello to Sue and Fiona. I've met Fiona before, but she didn't remember. That's always gratifying. And of course I know Sue, and so, you know, writers in New Zealand know each other, so
Now, yours is one of the few books from the finalists across all the categories that actually reappeared on the bestseller list. There seems to be a popular interest in it. Is that something that, even though you're living overseas, that you've been able to notice in terms of people talking about the book?
Of course. Because also, you know, Penguin emailed me to let me know it's on the bestseller list. I get the New Zealand Society of Authors email every Friday, keeping up with things. I was delighted that people were reading it again. It was really good.
And have people talk to you about the book, about the subject? Is it something that's sort of touched a nerve in that sense?
Oh, yeah, I get tons of emails from readers, tons and tons of emails. Sometimes people who have a connection to the book in some way because they are a descendant of one of the people mentioned in it, or just because they've read it and enjoyed it, or because they have family stories themselves and they want some advice on digging through them all. Or people always have suggestions for what you can write for your next book.
Ah, what are some of those suggestions?
Well, you know, they're always like, I've got a good story for you, and it's thank you very much, but
right.
I've got loads going on, so.
We'll talk about that in a minute. But in terms of your own family, Paratene always been part of the family law, or is it something that you've just only come to learn about in more recent years?
Well, he's a very important person in certain parts of the family, certain branches of the family. So the people who are based in Nungaru Turukaka, which is near Whangarei, he's a very important person. The marae is named after him. He founded the school in Nungaru, so he's always been a person of great mana there. But I'm from a different branch of the family. You know, our marae is at Pākeri, Lee, Omaha. More important in our family were Tenatahi and Rahui, who also play small parts in this novel, because they, of course, knew Paratene very well. They were among the last owners of Little Barrier. So, but for me, it was great to be able to honour him with the book and honour his story. And I hope the people in Nungaru feel that I did him justice.
Have you had any sense of feedback there?
Oh, yes.
Have you been there with the book for any events?
I've been up there. They don't have events in Nungaru, please.
Right.
Unless it's the Nungaru Dairy. They came down for the book launch. A whole lot of people came down from the marae, which I was very grateful for. And one of the teachers at the school brought down a group of pupils who had done a history project on Paratene. And it was wonderful to have them there. Really wonderful.
Yeah. And the painting we were talking just before the interview is still up on the wall in the Auckland Art Gallery?
Well, the James Smetham painting is. So the painting...
Not the Lindau.
Yeah, not the Lindau. No. The Lindau has not been on display, unfortunately, for some time. But the James Smetham painting, which is kind of a bizarre rendition of the group who went to England, is up at the Auckland City Art Gallery at the moment. Normally it's at the Hocken Collection in Dunedin. So I've been to see it, and I was so excited. I stood too close when a security guard approached I think he thought we were going to damage the painting in some way. We were going to attack it, but we didn't.
Where's the Lindau? Just behind closed doors in storage. Yeah, yes. Storage. So what? Maybe this would smoke it out.
That would be fantastic because it is a beautiful, beautiful painting, and it would be really great, as with all the Lindau and Goldie paintings, for descendants to get to see it.
A lot of research went into this book. I mean, obviously, you knew going in a fair amount about Paratene, but you've spent how many years researching it?
Well, since the very first time, it was the very first time I started looking at something, it was 2002.
Right.
But I have to say, I never do as much research as everyone thinks I do. I do a lot of going to places. Like, I went up to Nungaroo, I went to the Isle of Wight, where he met Queen Victoria, I went to Birmingham, where their whole trip fell apart, to tour Birmingham Town Hall. That kind of thing I find quite useful. There's very little actual documentary evidence to go on, especially in New Zealand. I mean, there's quite a lot of coverage of the trip to England that the group undertook because there's newspaper coverage. But here in New Zealand, there are just fragments of life. I mean, there's a couple of letters, there's some native land court testimony that a researcher helped me uncover and she translated for me. But they're really small fragments. There's certainly not enough to write any sort of non-fiction project about him. Absolutely not. Vast amounts in the book are just made up.
And so no real sense of character existing from those research documents. So you've completely had to invent from the ground up.
Well, you get a little bit of a flavour of a person, particularly from the oral history he left when he was in his 90s. I got the idea of his sense of humour and also of what he had edited out of his life. That he was very detailed about the war parties he fought with as a young man, and he mentioned the trip to England. Everything else is left out. Family, children, because he did marry and have children, none of whom survived him. None of the dark periods of his life, maybe, you could say. And that started interesting me as to what you actually choose to remember when you're old and what you choose to leave out. The letters he wrote, there were a couple from the English trip, and you have to always think about the context in which things are written. They were written, you know, because people in the Church Missionary Society, who had befriended them in England, wanted them to basically say bad things about the Wesleyans who'd taken them over there. So if you imagine there's some kind of political intent behind the letters. So you can't always trust them to be a true reflection of what he really thought, especially in retrospect. They were sort of written in the heat of the moment with people saying, write down all the terrible things that happened because we kind of need it as evidence. So you're trying to, it's almost like detective work.
Right. But, I mean, following them around like that, obviously research material for the book, but how was that at a more personal level? I mean, it must have been strange to be following in his path, literally, to these various places.
That was the exciting part. I loved doing that. Went to Marlborough House in Pall Mall in London, which is now the Commonwealth Secretariat. When he visited it, it was the home of the Prince and Princess of Wales, the future Edward VII. And so I know I'm going in the door that he went in. I know from the historical record where he was, you know, interviewed, where the group was interviewed by the Prince and Princess of Wales. I know that he was taken in to see their wedding presents, and I went on a tour of the house where they showed me where that would have taken place. So that was really exciting to think, okay, he stood on this floor and he saw this incredible mural on the wall of the Duke of Marlborough's military exploits. And I mean, that kind of thing I find really kind of exciting, imaginative.
Yes, transporting. Mm. David Eggleton, who was one of the judges, said last night that one of the things about historic novels is they can often tell you as much about the present as the past, or about our interests and so forth. Your novel, in that respect, particularly, I was thinking towards the end, you talk about the way that he's moved from kind of knowable battles to the sort of much more slippery world of courts and language and so forth. What do you think your book sort of tells us about now?
I don't know, because it's always hard to think about your own book, you know, in those terms. So I do agree with David. I think that historical novels do sort of shine a light on the present, because it's how did we get to the place we're at now? How did we become the people we are now? How did New Zealand become the place it is now? 200 years ago, it was profoundly different. Just 200 years ago, it was a Maori country. There were just a sprinkling of Europeans here. By the end of the 19th century, that was completely reversed. And so in Paratene's own lifetime, he saw New Zealand completely transform into a place where he, like Lindauer, was essentially a foreigner, speaking a foreign language. So I'm very interested in that, because there are obviously ramifications for New Zealand now. You know, who belongs, who doesn't belong, what's real, what's indigenous, what's authentic, you know, who has rights, who doesn't, you know, the whole issue ongoing of people coming into the country and the nature of the country changing in response to immigration, as all countries do. So I suppose it's just, you know, his story is just a part of the process of New Zealand becoming New Zealand. And countries are not fixed things, especially young countries like ours. I mean, young in one sense, that we're in always in a period of flux of with our identity. And that goes on today. Even, you know, in my very short lifetime, here in Auckland, I've seen Auckland change radically.
The reference to the courts and the language of the legal language, I mean, would seem could be read more pointedly, probably, than that, in terms of you know, the ongoing disputes over the Treaty Waitangi and so forth.
Oh, absolutely, it's still going on. What was going on in the 19th century at the Native Land Court then became what was going on at the Maori Land Court, then Waitangi Tribunal. On it goes, on it goes. I mean, there was a recent settlement for Ngāti Wai with Little Barrier, but there's still endless disputes, and there will be always, because that's what happens when things get messed up in history. They need to get resolved in some way, and it might take many centuries to resolve it.
At one level, the book could possibly be read as an elaborate metaphor for New Zealand's fate at the Frankfurt Book Fair. What do you think awaits us there in terms of some of the, you know, the themes of the exotic, the circus of exotica?
Absolutely, we're the spectacle of the other, are we not? And that's been quite interesting, because I've already been over to Germany a couple of times, to Frankfurt and to Hamburg, to talk to journalists. And it is very interesting. They're extremely interested in New Zealand, but many of them don't know very much about New Zealand. Fair enough. Why should they? But it's quite interesting, often, this perception of us as this sort of paradise, idyllic paradise, very benign, very beautiful, very boring. And while New Zealand is a very beautiful country, as I always say to them, Germany's quite beautiful as well. But like all countries, we have our dark sides, our shadows, our, you know, historic splotches, our political dissent, our unhappiness, our private dramas, our domestic dramas, like all countries, you know. And our literature obviously reflects that. So kind of what we're doing in Frankfurt is undermining the work of the New Zealand Tourist Board by going to say, actually, it's not quite as nice.
Right.
And actually, that's a good thing, because it makes us a complex real country, of course.
Yes, a grown-up adult.
Yeah, yeah, not some sort of blank space onto which you can project your fantasies of the South Seas. So I do think that encounter in Frankfurt is going to be very interesting and informative. And also interesting for us to go over there and learn about Europe. I mean, how much do we know about European literature, necessarily? Because so little is translated for us. I mean, in some ways, we're in a similar position to the Europeans. They have very little translated into English. We in New Zealand have very little that makes it up into the Northern Hemisphere. So I think it's going to be an interesting encounter. Hopefully, it will not be like Paratene and Co. in England. It won't end in humiliation and poverty. Maybe for the New Zealand government, hopefully not for the writers.
The I mean, one of the themes in the book, and also a theme coincidentally in Hamish Clayton's book too, Wolf, is the question of translation itself. You know, what the, you know, how your words are translated. Have you been very eagle-eyed over the German translation of this book?
No, because I'm sure there'll be many things that I would disagree with in translation. But at some point, as an author, you have to let things go. You can't really micromanage your life. It will drive you crazy. And so sometimes you just have to stand back and let other people take over. I didn't want to be crazy about it, to be honest. I'd be interested. My sister is a German speaker, so I'm going to get her a copy of the book, and doubtless she will find entertaining things in it.
Yes.
But I do trust them. They're a good publishing house. They're lavishing a lot of care and
attention. Can you say a bit about that? Because you were describing before to me, before the interview, the way it's being printed, published there, which is quite a far cry from how books tend to be published here at the moment.
It's coming out in hardback in German, coming out in Switzerland, Austria, Germany. And I can't wait to get my hands on a hardback copy. It looks beautiful. I've seen the cover, and they've talked about illustrations within, so I hope those are just the maps. I don't know what else they could be. But I'm really looking forward to seeing it. And, yeah, Walder & Graf is the imprint. They're Zurich-based, but they're a part of a bigger German publishing group. And they certainly seem to be, you know, spending a lot of time and thought on it, so It's very exciting.
Historic novels in New Zealand are always very popular, and they can be a temptation probably for writers in terms of selling books. Another historic novel next, or going to keep away from that?
Are they really big sellers, are they?
They are. Well, look at Jenny Patrick.
Yeah, but...
And in her wake, you know, anybody who has written a historic novel in her wake has, you know, seen it in the top 10 and often number one.
Okay, well, I would like to say to all the readers of Jenny Patrick, please read Rangatira. Go right ahead. I don't know. I think that I write the books that I want to write at the time that sort of grab me. I would actually have liked to have avoided writing a historical novel because it sucked up years of my life. Because you feel like there's so much work to be done to get the authentic voice, to get the authentic detail. So you end up doing far too much research, of course. You know, far too much, the things you can't use.
So what are you writing something now that's liberating in that respect? You can just completely rely on your own imagination?
Well, I just wrote another young adult novel for Scholastic. You know, I write young adult novels as well for Scholastic in the US, which actually didn't require very much research, I have to say. A little bit, but not much. I'm working on a play right now, my first play. I'm going to give that a go. And that does actually require some research because it is set in 1925 in France. But again, I'm not doing it cynically because I think, oh, a historical play that's sure to take the National Theatre by storm. It's the story that interests me. And I don't know, it would be nice to be a cynical writer who thinks, you know, I can write, 50 Shades of Grey. Well, I can do similar. I'm sure there are many people doing similar right now. But if you're going to give years of your life to something, it has to be something you're passionate about and really passionately interested in. Otherwise, you'll drive yourself mad and you won't do it. You won't finish it.
And in the same respect, do awards like this kind of matter? Or are you, you know, obviously when you win, they're nice, but when you don't win, you can't really presumably allow that to affect you. You kind of, that's not what you're doing it for.
No, well, those 2 years I didn't win as listener reviewer, I just picked myself up and just continued reviewing bravely. I don't know. I was very happy to win. Very happy that the book gets the recognition because it means people are talking about the book again. You know, the news this morning, my mother heard it on the news, on the station she listens to, my sister heard it on the news, the station she listens to. It's wonderful to have books in the news, and not because they are erotica that have sold millions of copies, but just because they're New Zealand books that have won an award. And anything we can do to bring our stories to public attention is fantastic. And hopefully, you know, hopefully more people now will read the book. That's all you want. You want people to read it. You don't care if they like it or not. You just want them to read it. You do. I mean, it's true. What can you do? You can't change it now. This is it.
Well, hopefully you haven't been too burned by the bear pit that is the New Zealand Listener Book Club.
Well, I try not to read reviews, especially by just, you know, I don't like Amazon reviews or Goodreads reviews or book club reviews, because often it does end up with a sort of gang mentality where they're going to bring you down. I remember talking about this with Claire Massoud, who agreed to take part, you know, the American writer Claire Massoud, agreed to take part in some Barnes & Noble Meet the Reader chat online. She said it was so traumatising an experience, she vowed never to do it again. And Curtis Sittenfeld, another American writer, has written a very amusing article about going along to some book clubs where, you know, to your face, they say, I don't like this, I didn't like that, I don't like the character. And she just found it a dismaying experience, dispiriting. Obviously you can't please all people with your book. And in fact, the more people that read your book, the more likely you are to find people who don't like it as well as like it. What good does it do? Some people think your book is awesome, a work of genius. Other people hate it. What can you do? It's the book you wrote. And all you have to hope is that you wrote the book you wanted to write, or as close to it as possible. Obviously, they never really match up to the work of great brilliance in your imagination, but you have to feel proud of it. You hand it over and you think, this is what it is.
Unless if you're Whitty Himara, you could, of course, go back and write it again.
That, to me, is the road to madness for me, because I love revising, and I would happily revise everything, but sometimes it's good to keep moving on, I think, moving forward, and learn from... Every book teaches you something about how to write. And this is, you know, to write another first-person book, but this time from the point of view of an elderly man who lived in the 19th century and was as completely different from me as possible, really, in terms of his life experience and his belief system. I mean, he went from you know, someone born into pre-Christian New Zealand who lived that way for the first maybe 30 years of his life to someone who became quite a devout Christian. I don't fall into either of those groups. So trying to understand both mentalities and how they coexisted within his psyche was really a challenge, an interesting one. But that's, you know, writing, like reading, is about making an imaginative leap into someone who is not you. And so I can't be bothered when people say they couldn't relate to things. It's like, well, books are not about us necessarily, you know. My students say this all the time, I couldn't relate to it because, you know, the character's not me. It's like, other people are not us, and books are not about us. They're about what they're about, and we make the leap towards them.
Is this a book that you could have written earlier in your career, or do you think it's one you had to grow towards?
I don't think I could have written it earlier. I don't think I could have. I mean, but I do think every book is sort of another step, isn't it? So think, okay, now I know I can do this, and now I can try something else. I mean, that's why I'm keen to write a play. It's like, let's see, can I do this now? I probably couldn't have 10 years ago, or 5 years ago, or maybe two.
Well, we hope to see it at BATS, perhaps. You probably have other aims for it.
I don't know you and your Wellington references. What is this? It'll be at the...
National Theatre.
Wherever.
Cottesloe.
It'll probably be in some, you know, vast open space attended by hundreds of thousands of people. We can
much like the Meet the Authors event that you've just come from. Paula Morris, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
We'll be back next month with our book club, and we'll be talking about David Ballantyne's Sydney Bridge Upside Down. Have you read that, Paula?
No, but good luck to him.
He's dead.